Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Inyar, America's most popular self-proclaimed right-wing religious fanatic, heterosexual, anti-choice talk show host. A lot of news to talk about a little later in the show. Real exciting news about the burial box that was apparently found just south of the Mount of Olives with an inscription that the person's bones who were originally buried in that box, James, the brother of Jesus, son of Joseph. So we'll be talking about that a little later in the program. That's exciting. Another tragic shooting this morning in the Washington, D.C. area by the sniper. Interesting news and developments with Iraq. But what we wanted to start with, an update on something that we talk about from time to time on this program, and it's our missile defense program. Our missile defense system, as many of you know, that I used to work for McDonnell Douglas Helicopter Company on the Apache. So we're interested in defense technology issues. And I often hear in the media that it's pretty much impossible. It's not worth the money. It can't be done to shoot down an incoming missile with a missile. It's just too difficult. But there was another test just about a week ago. And the Missile Defense Agency, in fact, part of the Defense Department, there's a spokesperson with them, Chris Taylor. Chris, I'd like to welcome you to Bob Inyar Live.
Thanks, Bob.
Hey, can you tell us how the latest test went?
Well, a few days ago, a target was launched out of Vandenberg, and about 22 minutes later, and 4,800 miles away at the Ronald Reagan missile site in Kwajalein Atoll, an interceptor was launched. And about 6 minutes after the interceptor was launched, at an altitude in excess of 140 miles above the Earth, and during the mid-course, what we call the mid-course phase of the target's warhead's flight, we had our fifth successful intercept, the fourth consecutive in seven flight test since October of 1999.
So five successful out of seven tests, four in a row.
Well, fourth consecutive. This was the fifth successful intercept in seven flight tests.
Okay. All right. And explain to us the difficulty. An incoming missile is traveling, obviously, at a high rate of speed.
The intercept is roughly about 15,000 miles an hour. And basically, it's been called what they call a hit-to-kill technology.
Hit-to-kill? It's
hitting a bullet with a bullet.
In other words, when you send up the kill vehicle to destroy the incoming missile, that kill vehicle doesn't have a warhead on it. There's no explosives. It has to hit the missile.
That is correct.
Now, that...
And it basically obliterates the warhead in flight.
It's been described, the difficulty has been described as though trying to hit a bullet with a bullet.
That is correct.
As though a sniper with a rifle a few hundred yards away shoots, and you've got to shoot and hit the bullet. It's obviously extraordinarily difficult. And I know that, well, the Soviet Union, that doesn't exist anymore, but some of the foreign countries, their national policy has been against us building such a system. But many people have said it could not be done technically, and so it seems that we're showing that, well, technically, even though there are still hurdles to overcome, have you guys proved the concept now?
Well, we're quite pleased with not only the success in this particular program, what we call the ground-based program or the old National Missile Defense Program, but also the sea-based element as well. We've had two successful intercepts, two out of two, and there'll be a third test coming up well before the end of this calendar year.
Mm-hmm.
But If I may, there are a couple of interesting things since the with our leaving the ABM treaty. You know, we're allowed to build a ballistic missile defense against any and all threats. And what we're working to build is what they call a multi-layered defense that would attack targets or defend against targets in three various phases of flight. The boost phase, which is shortly after takeoff, the mid-course phase, which is from the time the warhead would enter outer space until it re-enters from outer space, and then the terminal phase, which is from where it re-enters from outer space until it would hit the target.
Now, on the boost,
we've got the Patriot PAC-3 on the terminal phase. On the mid-course phase, we've got the ground-based system, which we just completed this most recent test. We've got the sea-based system. And then in the boost phase, we're working on a couple of items, one of which is the airborne laser program, which is putting a high-energy laser aboard a modified 747. Mm-hmm. And a second phase, which is being under consideration now, is what they call a multi-use interceptor, which is that you would be able to launch a missile that would actually run down the target in the boost phase. And you're basically looking at something that would have to travel in excess of about 6 kilometers per second.
Mm. Wow. Now, Chris Taylor, let me ask you this. This program, these tests that are conducted are the most expensive tests that the Pentagon has ever funded, as far as I've read, if that's accurate. The whole project is very expensive, but of course, the cost of allowing one incoming missile to strike one of our cities is just unthinkable. But are there any potential spinoffs to the technology, the raw research that's going on, that may be a collateral benefit? Has that been discussed?
Well, there are a number of what's the word I'm looking for? There have been a number of things that we've been able to glean from research that's been developed for missile defense, but mm-hmm. has been able to be used in other areas. One of which is, for example, the laser technology that we've used has been instrumental in developing LASIK surgery. Hmm. So all those boomers who've had problems with their eyesight and have decided to have LASIK surgery, you can actually contribute part of that benefit back to the research that was done for missile defense.
And NASA has just a couple weeks ago announced that they're working on research that if any asteroids, near-Earth asteroids, in the future, if we find that they're coming a little too close to comfort, they've proposed, and they're now studying the feasibility of a laser system to help divert those asteroids, just to boost them, to nudge them a little. So it seems like things like that also could get a jump start because of this basic research.
I actually don't have a handle on that particular topic, mm-hmm. but it sounds feasible.
Yeah. Well, Chris, so basically it looks like a thumbs up that things are working and that that research is going to proceed. Israel, we've seen in the news, will be the first country to deploy a nationwide missile defense system. That's exciting. Our country, we're far away from any thought of that, right?
Well, that's, again, with the getting out of the ABM treaty allows us to build a missile defense against all threats. Mm-hmm. And as I say, it's a multi-layered system that we're working towards. I guess one of the best analogies would be it's similar to the defense on a football team. Mm. The boost phase, knocking the ball down behind the line of scrimmage.
Right, the sack.
With the idea that if you can knock it down in the boost phase, then if there is any debris, it would fall on the bad guys.
Right.
And the mid-course would be comparable to the linebackers, and the terminal phase would be like the corners of the free safeties.
Mm-hmm. Now, that's something our audience can understand, Chris. So, all right,
I'm about briefly, Bob.
I'm sorry we're breaking up here. Chris, we're about out of time. I want to thank you for the audience and for myself. Just let you know, I pastor Denver Bible Church, And if you're ever in Denver, please, you have a standing invitation to come and give our congregation an update.
Well, thanks for the opportunity to talk to your listeners, Bob. And if I get to Denver, I'll look you up.
Okay. All right. Appreciate that. Goodbye. Nice
Thank
to have you.
You
on the show. And, you know, Chris was breaking up there at the end. We don't know why. So we will we'll keep in touch with Chris, though, as perhaps with the next test, let you guys know how things go with that test. Yeah, my son Nathaniel saw a special on public television a couple weeks ago where they said the whole system basically is a complete failure. And it's interesting to see the difference between news as reported by liberals and then reality. Really is interesting to observe the difference. We'll be right back. A live commercial break here, and this is just for those on the internet. You might have noticed that we took that segment 2 minutes long. Sometimes when we have a guest, we do that. Especially if we have a guest scheduled for just one segment and we want to conclude, we just eat into the commercial break by a couple minutes. And so when we do that, of course, that affects our ability to pay our bills that week. So we have to condense our commercials. Just like to let you know how things operate here. So our phone number, if you're listening on KGov, you can find our phone number on the website or click on the upper right-hand corner where it says Bob's Materials, and you can check out our videos, literature, audio tapes, and help the show. Our phone number, 1-800-8-NYART. That's 1-800-836-9278. 1-800-836-9278. The find, this is pretty neat, this find, with this archaeological find. Now, there's an article about it today, is it, in the New York Times, and a journal, Biblical Archaeological Review, BAR. I think they're on the web at bar.org. They are going to do a lot about this find. It's basically a box in which when someone dies, they would bury them and then take their bones after all their flesh has decomposed and put their bones in this smaller box. And then the box would often have an inscription on it and bury the box. So this box was purchased 15 years ago by a collector for a small amount of money. And the collector really didn't know what he had until an authority in France on ancient inscriptions inspected the box and translated it, written in Aramaic, James, the son of Joseph, brother of Jesus. That's exciting. That's an exciting find. Israel, I believe it was their antiquities department, they've looked at the box. They've done microscopic analysis of it. They have been unable to cast any doubt on the authenticity of this as a first century artifact. Now, Josephus, the first century historian, the Jewish historian who was very friendly to the Romans, and he wrote extensively, 1,000 pages that we have extant to this day. You could read Josephus. I've read much of his writings over the last 25 years, but not all of his writings. But he does mention James. James, who was put to death because of his faith, he was martyred, James being the brother of Jesus, he says. And based on Josephus' timing, James would have been killed in A.D. 62. And the Jews, they only did this method of burial for a period of 90 years. They started 20 years before Christ, and they stopped doing this at A.D. 70 when Jerusalem was destroyed by the Roman general Titus. in AD 70. But what they did was they'd bury someone and their flesh would decompose. And then they take the bones and put them in a box for burial. And the inscription, the language, the style of the writing, it is just apparently it's perfect first century Aramaic. So what was done and the style it was done, obviously there are from time to time frauds that are foisted upon the public. For example, frauds like, say hominids that never existed, the supposedly ancestors of man, apes that evolved into man, ones that never existed. They were frauds. So things like that happen, and they could theoretically happen with religious artifacts also, of course, and they have. And so archaeologists and historians are extremely skeptical and very careful when they come across finds like this. But so far, it's exciting. It looks good. And James, the son of Joseph, brother of Jesus, were those names popular back in the first century? Were they common? Yeah, they were common. Those are common names. James is the Greek name for Jacob. So Jacob, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, Jacob, the father of the 12 tribes. Jesus is the Greek name for Joshua, the Hebrew Joshua. Jesus is Jesus in Greek. Jesus in Greek and Jesus in English. And then you have Joseph. Well, Joseph was one of the 12 sons of Jacob. So these are all names that are, very common Jewish names. But how many men named Jacob or James in the first century living in Jerusalem who would have been buried just south of the Mount of Olives would have had a father named Joseph and a brother named Jesus? That'd be pretty rare to have that combination. And then add to that the extraordinary rarity of putting a brother's name on the tombstone. What do you want on your tombstone? Hey, it's very unusual. Have you ever seen it in your life going to cemeteries? I'll ask people in the studio audience. Have any of you guys ever seen a brother's name on a tombstone? No. No, that's extraordinary. Now, in one of the articles I read about this, they said there's one instance of this known, that this was done in Aramaic, one tombstone, different names, but where a brother's name appeared on a tombstone. And so it's something that is extraordinarily rare. And it's neat, too. Now, I don't know what the Roman Catholics are going to do about it because they don't like to call James the brother of Jesus. But, okay, they just don't like it. Son of Joseph? What did Joseph do? If the Roman Catholics are right and Mary was ever virgin, see, the Bible says that Jesus had brothers and sisters. And it distinguishes between his followers and his brothers and sisters. And Jesus, the Bible says that Joseph did not have relations with Mary until Jesus, her firstborn, was she gave birth to. So those things all imply rather strongly or state that Mary had other kids. So, and when the Bible says, like Paul says, well, I went to Jerusalem and I saw Peter, and I also saw James, the Lord's brother. And the Catholics then have to deal with that. And they say, well, James wasn't the Lord's brother. He was just, since he was a believer, the believers were called brothers. Well, then what was Peter? Chopped liver? I saw Peter and James, the Lord's brother. What was Peter then? Wouldn't Peter be a brother in that sense? Of course, Paul was distinguishing between a normal apostle And then the man who had become the leader of the church in Jerusalem, James, the Lord's brother. So we have an album that most of this Bible study album I completed while in jail, in Jefferson County Jail, for spanking my stepson 5 swats on the backside. But I went to jail, and that was no reason to stop our Bible studies, so we continued recording them over the phone, because the jail I went to, well, one of the many jails I went to, this one jail, you could only be on the phone. They timed you, and they limited it. It was really a drag. You could only be, now, I don't want to get the numbers wrong, but I think it was 240 minutes a week, local calls, and another 400 minutes a week or so, long distance. That's all they allowed you. So we did our Bible studies, and we recorded our album, James and John, the brothers of James and Jude, the Lord's brothers. We recorded that album while in jail. So you can call us up, 1-888-8-NUR, and get that. Let's go to the phones in South Bend, Indiana. Craig, speak your mind.
Hey, Bob, how you doing?
Great, sir.
Good. You mentioned in Catholics, I had an experience over the weekend that kind of I've never had before.
Yeah.
Or came to realize before. Being from South Bend, Notre Dame country, there's a lot of Catholics there.
Oh, yeah.
And
I lived in South Bend for a couple of years.
Yeah, that's right.
We did the show out of LaCie Broadcasting's headquarters there, and I used to work at Notre Dame on the manuscript we sell,
right.
The plot.
I remember you talking about the reflection pool there and how that applied to the flood.
To Noah's flood. That's right.
They were over at my mom and dad's house. I had a family of people that were pretty sincere Catholics,
yeah,
as far as that goes. And my parents have a listing of the Ten Commandments, kind of on like a rendition of stone tablets.
Yeah.
And they pointed out that, in according to what the Catholics have taught, that the second commandment is not the same.
Right.
And I've never realized that before, that they take the tenth commandment that I'm used to and they split it into two and then eliminate the second commandment.
Yeah, the listing of the Ten Commandments that the Catholics have is different. They're the same words when you read them in their Bible, like in Exodus chapter 20 of a Catholic Bible. It's all the same words.
That's what I was wondering.
But when they put them on a plaque, they number them differently.
Okay.
They number them differently. In the 10th commandment, like do not covet your neighbor's goods, it goes on to list your neighbor's ox, your neighbor's this and that and that.
Yeah.
And so you could split that one into two if you wanted and eliminate the one that says, don't make graven images.
Yeah, and I thought that was really interesting that they would get rid of that one. And that question to them was, well, is Exodus 20, is it the same in the Catholic Bible? And they're like, well, we don't know. We'll have to look that up.
Well, yeah, it is the same. But, you know, except for every different translation of the Bible has its own idiosyncrasies.
Right.
Like when Jerome first translated the Bible into Latin centuries ago, then there had never been a Latin translation up to that point. And so the Latin translation, the Latin Vulgate, has had a big influence on the Catholic Church and has influenced their modern day translations more so than, say, it would have influenced the New King James, perhaps.
Okay.
But at any rate, basically, the Ten Commandments in Exodus are the same, but the Catholics, when they numbered them, they left out, do not have any graven images. They left that out as a separate commandment. And so some people have pointed out the irony of that.
Right.
Since the Catholic Church, even if they officially teach that you should not worship statues or pray to icons, they definitely have a problem in reality with millions of Catholics around the world who do worship statues and bow down before them and kiss them and pray to trinkets. So that is a problem. We're going to the news break at the bottom of the hour. We'll be right back. Hey, Bob and Yard here with a live commercial break, and this is only for those listening on the internet. Hey, I want to thank you guys for tuning in and let you know about some of our Bible study albums. We've got this album, Genesis the Flood. You know, if the flood really happened, a worldwide flood, then there should be a lot of evidence for it everywhere you look. In fact, all the major mountain ranges should have fossils of seashells on the summits of all the mountains. So when Moses wrote that all the mountains were covered by the waters of the flood, I wonder if he ran around to the Alps and the Rockies, all these mountain ranges, and if he stuck seashells up there just in case somebody was going to go look. Do you think he'd do that? I wonder how effective he would be. Because today, scientists tell us very readily that all the mountains were underwater, and there are fossilized sea creatures on the summits of all the mountain ranges in the world, all the major ancient mountain ranges. So isn't that neat? And we go through that kind of evidence. And all the deposits all over the world, all the strata and the continents, they're all evidence of the flood. And all the coal and the oil, those things are not formed today. Fossils are not being formed today. These things were all made from the flood. And then also in 100 cultures around the world, ancient cultures and modern, they tell stories. Anthropologists have collected stories of whether you go to the Eskimos in Alaska or Aborigines in Australia, anywhere in the world you want to go, ancient Egyptians, Babylonians, they have a story of a flood that wiped out everybody, and a handful of people were saved, usually in some kind of vessel. How could it be that there's 100 stories like that from all over the world? How about the Navajo Indians? You think they had a story of a great flood? They did. Virtually all the tribes in North America had a story of the flood. The Aztecs, the Mayans, flood stories. Where'd they all come from? Well, whether it's physical evidence or anthropological evidence, the evidence is there that the flood really happened. Bob Inyart here, 1-800-8-NYART, 1-800-836-9278. I grew up Catholic, and I don't have any desire or goal to do a bash Catholics show. I don't do that. We, you know, whether we need to bash United Methodists or Catholics or whoever, you know, we do it. We're an equal opportunity basher. And to the extent that the Catholic Church has serious problems, like, for example, the Pope, just criticizing the American bishops, remember, with all the children being molested by priests. Now, why do they have an epidemic of kids being molested by of priests molesting children? Well, the reason is because a few decades ago, they changed their policy and the Roman Catholic seminaries allowed homosexuals to enroll. The Roman Catholic seminaries in this country changed their policy so that homosexuals could enroll. They could be ordained as priests as long as they took a vow of celibacy. That was really sick policy. That's just sick. How about pedophiles? What if somebody went to a Catholic seminary and said, well, I'm only interested in having sex with young children, but I want to be a priest and I promise not to molest any of them. Oh, well, fine. Come on in. Just take your vow of celibacy. And sure, you could join up. Let's give your holy orders. That's just tragic. So when the Catholic seminaries decided to allow homosexuals to be admitted and then to be ordained as priests, that was just begging for this molestation epidemic. So the bishops got together to try to divert, you know, $100 million lawsuits because of all the kids who had been harmed, molested, even kids who've gone on to commit suicide. We read about one of them on the show with his, was it his aunt came in here with the suicide letter he left? He shot himself in the face after going on for 2 pages describing how this Roman Catholic priest had molested him in the weeks and couple months after his father had died. Young boy, and the priest came along to help the grieving family through the hard time. And he got the young boy, was he, I forget his age now, 13 years old. Would get him drunk, take him on trips, take him to hotel rooms, get him drunk, and molest him. And the kid, from that moment on, became an alcoholic, never overcame his alcoholism, and eventually killed himself. And he left a letter describing in detail, naming the priest. And the family members remember the priest coming along, befriending him, taking him on trips. And then all of a sudden, it all ended. So that's just one story out of hundreds? No, thousands of kids have been molested. So the bishops, they didn't come up with a zero-tolerance policy for child molesters. And we, along with millions of others, were discouraged by how wishy-washy their policy was that they laid out. And so even though it was wishy-washy, the Vatican and the Pope has condemned that policy as being too stiff and too rigid. They're against it. You know, what percentage of the priests in the Vatican are homosexual? I don't know. A significant percentage here at in the rectories in America where the priests live. So I don't know. But that's really discouraging. Too bad the bishops didn't come out and say any priest who molests a child should be executed. And that might not be the laws of the land, but that's what should happen. And we're going to turn them in and we're going to turn over all the evidence we have. So the case we did on this show where we had the, I think it was the aunt or the cousin. I'm sorry, I forget the relationship right now. But we had her in this summer, and her and I read this letter, except we had to censor it because he described the despicable things that this priest did to him. And so we didn't want to describe that on the air, of course. But then that priest, he had reported to the Denver Archdiocese. And so I called the Denver Archdiocese. The family called. The family went and met with the priests who were in charge of handling these issues. And the family had one request. They said, we would like the records on this priest. We would like to know which other churches he was assigned to before and after he was assigned to our small church. And we'd like to know if you guys were aware that he had charges against him, accusations against him previous to this, and then you moved him, or if there were charges after this. We'd like to know. And what would the Roman Catholic Archdiocese in Denver do in that circumstance? Would they say, we are so sorry for what happened to your family member, and of course, we'll be happy to share with you that very pertinent information? No, they said, the law doesn't require us to do that. We don't have to tell you anything. How's that? Is that anything like sorrow or repentance? Is it anything like it? Could sorrow be hiding in there somewhere? Could repentance be just a small force somewhere inside of that rather cruel response? No. Can't see any sorrow or any repentance, any remorse in that. Just a denial and self-defense. You know, the exact antithesis of the teachings of Jesus Christ. The antithesis of those. Public school teachers tuning in right now, feel free to look up antithesis in the dictionary. Our phone number, 1-800-8-NYART. That's 1-800-836-9278. I am getting very uncomfortable, not that my feelings matter, but with the way the police are handling the sniper case. Very uncomfortable. Because, you know, when the sniper is able to leave little clues and have the police and the national media jump at everything and everything that he says, and sort of like a dramatic cat and mouse game, obviously it increases his adrenaline. It plays right into a Hollywood script, and it only could any influence it could have on future murderers, serial murderers, can only be negative. It doesn't matter if he's caught and killed eventually. All the excitement of it and the notoriety. That's why in the novel that we have sold for some years, a novel that I wrote about Christians that take over the country, the novel is called The First 3 Days. The First 3 Days. What would a Christian government do in its first 3 days? That's the title of the novel. In that novel, the policy that the criminal justice authorities use is that they don't negotiate with murderers, with terrorists, with hostage takers. They don't negotiate. In fact, not only do they don't negotiate, they do not communicate with them. They don't communicate. That's the policy that we propose in this novel, The First 3 Days. And, you know, how would that work out? Well, many hostage takers want to get a message across. They want to get a message across. And so if they could communicate, if they could have the words of their message, their threats being broadcast by the police on national TV, you know, Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber, he wrote this paper and he wanted the media to publish it. He wanted the police to have the media publish it. And so they eventually published it. And because they published it, he was caught. And that's really great that he was caught. You know, the Unabomber should be caught and killed. That's what should happen. But a problem implicit in publishing his writings is that you provide a motive for future murderers to do the same thing. All I have to do is terrorize enough people, kill enough people, and the New York Times is going to publish my paper. Oh, yeah, they'll do it in hopes of catching me, but at least I'll get my arguments out in public. And right now, nobody's paying attention to me. So our procedure, our MO, is we would not negotiate, we would not communicate with a murderer, hostage taker, terrorist. Bob Inyart here. Our call in line to order something is 1-888-836-9278. I told you about our album, Genesis the Flood. And Genesis the Fall. Oh, is that a fun album? It's a lengthy one. It's one of our longest, 12 tapes, 12 audio tapes. When did Adam and Eve sin? How long after they were created? You know, you could really narrow it down. If you're very careful about considering the evidence that the Bible presents, did Adam and Eve sin? Let's say, starting from the day of their creation, did 100 years pass before they sinned, Adam and Eve? Did 10 years pass? 1 year? 1 month? On what order of magnitude was it? What length of time passed before Adam and Eve sinned? You know, it's really interesting that the Bible gives us a lot of information by which we can answer that question. We could definitely know the order of magnitude of the amount of time that passed. But then there's also information that we could piece together. Once we know the order of magnitude, we could probably narrow it down even more closely and really zero in on when did Adam and Eve sin. And that turns out to explain certain things that are true to this day. It's just a fascinating topic. But then also related to that topic is, when did Lucifer sin? When did Lucifer fall? And what was Lucifer's sin? Now, we know it was pride, but pride usually comes in a concrete shape. Not just pride, but in a particular circumstance. Yeah, Lucifer wanted to be like God, but how did he express that? What was his actual sin? And when was his sin? And why did God put Lucifer in the Garden of Eden in the first place? What in the world was that all about? Adam and Eve are innocent. Lucifer's there, tempts Eve. They fall. One son kills another son. Misery sets in. Well, if you're interested in these questions, call us up and order The Fall. Welcome back. Bob and Yart Live, 1-800-8-N-YART, 1-800-836-9278. If criminals know, if terrorists know, if snipers know that the national policy of law enforcement is that there is no negotiating with criminals, there's no communication with hostage takers or hijackers or terrorists, then that removes some of the motivation to get into that business in the first place. If there's just no way they're going to be able to negotiate because it's not your policy, you don't negotiate, then there will be less motivation. We've got a Coloradan from up in Fort Collins who was abducted by terrorists in Lebanon and held a hostage there for a couple years. And while he was being held, along with others, a Roman Catholic priest from England and others, there were liberals who were arguing that our government was remiss because we were not negotiating for their freedom. And of course, we conservatives had said how absolutely wrong that would be, that you simply do not negotiate. You don't pay a ransom for someone who's been kidnapped. You don't do it because you may win the freedom of that person, possibly, but you give the terrorists, the hijackers, the murderers, you give them huge motivation to kidnap and kill a lot more people. And in a sick way, you become an accomplice. You're being used by them. So anyway, we're against that. And our novel, The First 3 Days, What a Christian Government Would Do If It Was Suddenly in Power in America. What would it do in its first 3 days? We come out strongly in favor of no negotiating. And, you know, I try, in the middle of a crisis, you know, you don't want to be a Monday morning quarterback. You don't want to try to manage and criticize people who are in the middle of a tragedy every move. And I don't like that. And I think conservative talk show hosts have a huge weakness in that we do that. And I have tried for years not to do that. So, like, for example, in Afghanistan, I don't like George W. Bush, but I completely supported his prosecution of that war in Afghanistan. He did a fabulous job. I don't think it could have been done any better. I don't think it could have been done any better at all. It was just tremendous. With the minimal loss of American life and the Islamic extremists, yeah, they destroyed two buildings and they killed 3,000 people, but they lost an army. They lost the government. They lost the country. Imagine that. The goal of Islamic extremists is that country after country would have Islamic governments. And they had one in Afghanistan and they lost it. So how is that trade-off? Yeah, they killed 3,000 Americans and they lost the country. That was not a very good deal for them. That wasn't a very good deal. So I admire the way Afghanistan was fought. Our phone number, 1-800-8-NYART, 1-800-836-9278. So with the burial box that was found in Israel, James, this is pretty exciting. James, son of Joseph, brother of Jesus. How many characters in the Bible, how many people in the Bible have archaeologists and historians found references to outside of the Bible? How many people? Well, the number is just about exactly 100. About exactly 100. In fact, this find here, if it holds up and it's authentic, it might be 101. Because I'm not sure that there was any contemporaneous reference to Joseph, Jesus' stepfather, the father of James and others. I don't recall if he was on our list, because we have a list that we do in the Does God Exist seminar of 100 people in the Bible who have been found. That's pretty neat. You know, like one king in Egypt that the Bible mentions. An Egyptian king, not only was he, do secular historians know about him? Shishak is his name. But we found his body. We found his mummy. That's pretty cool. So one of the guys in the Bible from the Old Testament, we got his body. Some of them, we know what they look like because of inscriptions on coins and statues. And some of them, well, the oldest person in the Bible, I think, that we have an inscription of by name is King David. King David. That's pretty cool. But you go back before David, you go back to the time of Abraham. Now that's going way back. That's 1,000 years before David. That's way back there, 4,000 years ago. And do we have any evidence that Abraham existed? Well, we have the book of Genesis that talks about him. But liberals say, well, they didn't even have writing back then, the Jews and the people. And obviously that's been debunked. We know that they had writing. Now we know. Well, that's so long ago that obviously the story of Abraham was made up probably maybe 800 years before Christ, or 1,200 years after Abraham supposedly lived. That's when the Jews invented him so that they can have a story of where they came from. So that's the accusation that liberals make against Abraham being a real person. What is our defense of that? Other than that we believe the Bible is reliable, because they don't. So other than our belief that the Bible is reliable, do we have any other defense that Abraham, the story of Abraham in Genesis, is real? That it's true, it's valid. We do. And here is one argument we make. It's this, that archaeologists in the past couple centuries have learned a lot about life in the Mesopotamian Valley 2,000 years before Christ. They've learned a lot about the language and the culture, the currency, the manner of living, the servants, the price of things. Hundreds of details about what life was like in the time of Abraham. And guess what? Coincidentally, the details we've learned about life back then are consistent with the details in the book of Genesis that describe Abraham's life and Isaac's and Jacob's. They're consistent. What does that tell us? Well, some Jewish storyteller living 1,200 years later without the internet, without archaeological or historical tools or libraries to research, he would not be able to make up stories and include all kinds of contemporaneously accurate historical details. He wouldn't be able to do that. So because the story could not have been fabricated 1,000 years later, that gives extraordinary credibility to the veracity of the story itself. That doesn't prove the God of the Bible is the true God. All that evidence shows is that the story in Genesis about Abraham is most likely based on fact and that Abraham was a real person. That's all that evidence shows us. But when Jesus Christ refers to Abraham as a real person, then we add to the archaeological evidence the testimony of Jesus Christ. And Jesus Christ, being a man, he might be right or wrong. If he believed Abraham was a real person, well, maybe he believed that, but maybe he was wrong. But when you add to his own veracity, how credible is he, the credibility of Jesus Christ, when you add the evidence that he rose from the dead, as the Hebrew Scriptures prophesied the Messiah would rise from the dead, then all of a sudden, the credibility of his statements become convincing, compelling. And so that Jesus Christ told us that Adam and Eve were real people and that Moses was a real person and Abraham was a real person, David was a real person. That's pretty cool. Some skeptics have set out to say, well, the Apostle Paul, that whole story, that's not true. Apostle Paul never became, you know, no persecutor would ever become a Christian and convert to the religion of the people persecuting him. And we've got a couple of researchers in the past century who set out to write books to say that the Apostle Paul, the whole story was a fraud and he never got saved. And the ones I know about, as they did their research, they were convinced by how compelling the evidence is, and they became Christians. People set out to write books that Jesus Christ never rose from the dead. Some of them are dead now. But some of those guys, they started writing their books, and they realized the evidence was compelling that Christ rose from the dead. And James, the son of Joseph, brother of Jesus, we've found the limestone burial box that was used with the Aramaic words engraved on it. James, son of Joseph, brother of Jesus. This is Bob and Yurt reminding you to do right and risk the consequences.